I'm going to talk tonight about the analogy between music and human relationships. The reason I'm going to talk about it is because it is a real one. It is not a simple figure of speech, a poetic image. There is a real relationship because the essence of the study of music is the study of vibrational relationships, and the essence of human relationships is likewise the study of vibrational relationships. I'm surrounded by various devices, and as you know, I'm a one-handed piano player, and I shall play with a few of the fingers on the one hand to demonstrate certain things. First of all, we have to define what we mean by sound. The word sound has two usages. One is the sensation produced in the sensorium of a human being. We assume animals also, but we don't know about that firsthand. The sensation produced in the human sensorium by a stimulus acting upon the hearing apparatus, the ear, in its full significance. The eardrum and all processes that go deeper into the brain. The same word, sound, is used for the external cause of such stimulation of the ear. So we think about sound as a sensation that we have, and sound as the external cause of such sensation. Now, it is usual to analyze sound in terms of vibrations, and the easiest way to discuss a vibration is to draw a wave and then translate the imagery of that in another way. At the bottom of the picture you can see a straight line and then a curve like an S laid across it going up and down. Up above the line, a semicircle, down below the line, another semicircle. Now we are to imagine that the straight line represents a string. I'm wondering whether to interrupt Gerhard and get him to join in to impede his note taking. Would you like to do that, Gerhard? And your fair spouse will take notes for you, and you will crib later from her. Yes, I want you to come up, and you will find roving about the floor a piece of rope. Did you remove the lighter cord that was there, David? It's like getting rid of light-hearted personalities. It should be, yeah. If it comes away, Gerhard, and you haven't fiddled with it, it won't be your fault. Right? Will you pull the rope taut first? Now, I want you to think that taut rope is represented by the straight line in the bottom diagram. We will call that the mean line, around which oscillations or waveforms will occur. The mean line represented here. Now I want Gerhard to shake his hand by throwing the rope up in the air, and you'll observe, you keep hold of it by the way, you don't let go of it.
You want me to keep it taut?
Well, you can't do it if you keep it taut, can you? You won't be able to generate a wave. Well, you've got to slacken it to get the wave, haven't you? I think the whole of that rope is waving at the moment, suspended from there and there, and there are no complex, don't make any complex waveforms. Keep it simple there, out first. Going, flying up and flying down. And that's giving you a waveform that goes up in the centre and then down in the centre, and the full length of the rope is involved in making that wave. And we will call that the fundamental of that rope. Now, if he begins to accelerate his hand movements, you will find the parts of the rope start going up when other parts are going down. And you can see, don't deliberately rotate it, Gerhard. It will tend to rotate, but you can see the effect of it's down in one place and going up in another and down in another. And the subdivisions of that rope we call partials of the fundamental. This is terribly important for us. The more rapidly Gerhard pulls that rope, the more he will be able to induce into it quite complex wave patterns, which will be quite difficult to observe. And each one of these sub-waves upon it is a partial of the fundamental. Right? Would you like to have a little rest now, Gerhard? Was that hard work?
Get a bit warm.
Get a bit warm, yes. Well, if you'd stayed there all night, as I would like you to, you'd be very hot. But mercy is above accepted sway, so we'll let Gerhard, and we will return him in a moment, just when he's settled down, to do another experiment. We have then a length of rope, and it can vibrate up and down without any complexities, as if suspended from two points. And we will call that the fundamental. But we can also stimulate the rope by waving the hand at various speeds, and we can cut the action of the rope so that many little waves appear in it. And those are partials. Now, in our analogy with human relationships, this will be very important, because the full length of a rope is like the full length, the whole length, of a human individual vibrating simply in his own way. You get this most obviously illustrated when you focus on your diaphragm in a calm state of mind. You will find the diaphragm goes up and then down, up and down, like the rope is doing, in its simple waveform. Except that action is across your diaphragm. Now, the thing about that wave, it's going up and down across the median line. Because it's going across it, we call it a transverse wave. Transverse is going across the direction of the wave motion. The wave is apparently going along the rope, but the wave is going up and down at right angles to the apparent propagation. Now, this is where we have to do a special translation for sound waves. That wave on the rope is like the wave on the water when you have a vigorous bath or a calm bath, and you see the surface of the water is going up and down. And if when you get in the bath, you lie very, very quietly and keep all your limbs still, you will find that your diaphragm going up and down induces a wave, and you can actually count on the waves going to the end of the bath and coming back, what is called the periodicity of the wave, how many times that wave will go from your diaphragm to the bath and be reflected back. It is periodic. It has a cycle. The diaphragm goes down and then it goes up and then it goes down again. And in the top part of the diagram, you see the wave goes up, then it goes down, and then it comes up again. And I could have repeated this diagram if I'd have had a piece of paper long enough indefinitely. And we would have seen a cyclic repetition of the waveform. Now, I think every human being is, first of all, before differentiation into your present complicated structures, a sphere, somewhat as Plato described it. The soul is a sphere. The energy constituting the human being in its natural economic distribution is spherical. We can then take a diameter through that sphere and think of that diameter as the mean or median line across which the diaphragm moves up and down. Now, you know that there's a very strong emotional relationship evidenced in the movements of the diaphragm. If you get excited, your diaphragm behaves in a different way from if you are calm. We have to let these facts sink into us to get the benefit of the analogy. Think of the sphere of the soul as a sensorium. That is to say, a definite mass of energy which is sentient. The energy is always sentient, and it feels its own expansion and contraction. Now, if it is spherical, how are we going to represent it on a plane diagram? We could draw a circle big, and then we could move along the page and draw the circle getting smaller, a little circle, and then we could draw one getting bigger, and again we would have a cycle, full phase expanded, minimum phase contracted, full expansion again. We would make a kind of figure of eight out of it. But the diagram would not be true, because we would have to draw it moving along the paper. Whereas in fact, we don't have to move about in order to breathe. So we expand and we contract in our chest, and so does every cell in the body. And this expansion, we can call the expanded phase, the maximum phase, and the greatest degree of contraction we can call the minimum phase. And we can talk about oscillating between maxima and minima without moving about in space, but just sitting where we are. Now, the essence of a sound wave is that, unlike a water wave, which we can represent travelling along a mean line, the sound wave is actually an alternation of compression and decompression. And the compression of the air travelling along hits you in the eardrum, and immediately after the compression phase, there is a decompression phase, so that the ear is struck, and then not struck, and then struck again, and not struck. And it can be struck a certain number of times per second. And the number of times per second determines musically what we call the pitch of the note. So if I strike a note here, and I strike another note here, there is a relationship, an octave multiplication there. We've doubled the frequency from this C here. We've doubled it there. We've doubled it again. We've doubled it again. We've doubled it again. We've doubled it again. When we're doubling the frequencies, you see this sound goes quite well. It fits well together. There are two notes sounding. We call them an octave. It sounds like one note, but somehow richer. What has happened is a length of string in the piano so long, and another length, exactly half the length of the first one, has also sounded. And because it's exactly half the length, it can vibrate comfortably with it. If it were not an exact half, it wouldn't vibrate in quite the same way. And when we think about the partials of this rope here, we can see that any given subdivision of it, if the whole of it is waving up and down, any single part of it must be likewise moving up and down. Now, suppose we say to ourselves, how can we get a reading to show, to illustrate to ourselves what can happen? If we get a certain kind of note, and we play that note, we say this, and listen to it, what is actually happening, our hearing apparatus is vibrating there at 256 cycles per second. And double it up, 512 and so on, up the piano for the octaves, so-called. When they fit together numerically in true proportion, we have a pleasant, easy sound. Plato thought music was very educational and that it could give you an education that no other study could do. It could give you harmony, which a study of anything else would not do. That it is actually possible to harmonize the body by listening to music in a way that's a study of Marxist dialectics applied in late 19th century, early 20th century Germany would not do. You can take any art other than music and it cannot give you what music can do. The reason is quite simple. Music actually vibrates your organism, the whole of it, that's your fundamental, and every part of it, that is every partial. So it vibrates the cells in your body, and it vibrates the nuclei of the cells, and it vibrates all the elements in the cytoplasm of your cells, so that music is actually massaging your body. It's massaging your body by compressing and then decompressing all the cells. It does it wholly, and it does it partially, and it does whole and part simultaneously. Let's consider this very carefully. We have the periodicity, we have frequency per second of the beats, the frequency per sec there, 256, the frequency there, 512. They go together very charmingly. Listen to the sound. This one is simple, insofar as the piano is a good one. This one is simple. And if we strike both together, you will hear a fuller sound. If you listen to the top, which you can actually do by act of will, the top frequencies, you will hear this note more than that one. But if you listen to the lower ones, deliberately attend to lower sounds, you will hear that one instead of that one. Will you do that and tell me if it's true? Can you hear that component? Can you hear this component? I'll play both together. And by switching your mind up and down, you can actually select the higher from the lower. Are we agreed about that? If we have any deaf people in the place, we can illustrate it to them by thumping them 256 times a second, and they will get the same effect as this note. Is there a deaf person in the house who would like to undergo this? And if so, shall I semaphore it? This is going to be tremendously important in human relationships because of a very peculiar thing. To get the same effect on their body wholly and partially in the cells of massage. So it would actually do the cells good even if there were a deficiency in the ear, so they couldn't actually, in the sensorium, say, I have heard it. But they would actually feel it in the cells. You could massage a deaf person with music, haptically. And if you like to amplify it, which you can do with electronic techniques, you can actually make them very, very aware that they are being massaged by it. You can make the whole body vibrate. And if you play certain dissonances, you could disintegrate it. There are many industrial damages to the ear, including complete deafness, caused by certain frequencies above the normal hearing level, which, because they're dissonant, can actually cut the ear to pieces on the inside. Now, when we strike the piano, the note fades away very quickly unless we put a foot on the right-hand pedal, which is called the sustaining pedal. Now, the reason for doing this on the piano is because if we didn't damp the strings, after we had struck them, they would all keep sounding, and the result would be mush. It would be exactly as if I did this. Now, if you will listen to that sound, you can listen up and down, listen for high, listen for low, listen for medium, and you'll find certain sounds tend to come out more than other sounds. Can you hear them? Can you believe that every individual in this room will be listening for slightly different notes in that chaotic mass of sound? Now, if I press, I'll press the A there, lift my finger up, if the dampers are working, which they should be in a relatively new, even if borrowed, piano, if the dampers work, it cuts out. Now, if I press it down and then put the sustaining pedal down, can you hear the change of tone? Let me do it again. That's down, pedal on. Can you hear that it gets fuller when I put the pedal on? That's not because that string is vibrating more fully. It's because the vibrations of that string, with their subdivisions, have partials in them that are actually vibrationally related to the other string's lengths and their partials. So if I were to play, and then play together, and then put the sustaining pedal on, now they're continuing to sound, aren't they? Can you hear any other notes other than the ones I struck by thinking up and down? When you're learning to play violin, one of the things you learn is to play a six and listen to it. Here is a six. C to A there. Can you hear some more notes? Now, if you're exactly on pitch with your fingers in the right place, you'll get a very full note. And if you're not exactly on pitch, you won't get a full note. Now, imagine exactly the same thing happens with a human being. Each human individual is like a certain length of string, the diameter of a sphere, a sensorium of power, and that sensorium of power vibrates when any stimulus comes to it of any energy kind whatever. We live inside a continuum of energy, a space-time power continuum. And every energy traveling through space, hitting upon a sensorium, induces in it alternations of compression and decompression, which we analyze in two dimensions on a piece of paper as waveforms, but we are to translate the waves as if the part of the wave that goes above the line we think of as an expansion, and the part that goes below the line we think of as a compression. Alternation, expansion, compression. Expansion, compression. Psychologically, elation, depression. Elation, depression. In elation, your sensorium expands. In a depression, it contracts. And it does this when any kind of stimulus, whatever, hits that sensorium. Now, one of the things we have a tendency towards as human beings is talking, conversing, releasing words from the organism. These words go out and they impinge on the ears of other beings and they vibrate the sensorium. Now, if I could have for one moment Gerhardt's assistance again, this will require less effort, but it will be interesting. When you come up, Gerhardt, will you not disturb these strings? Don't touch them a moment. I want you to see what happens. You see this one here, Gerhardt? Very, very gently, so that you don't disturb the others, or disturb as little as possible. Move it this way without...
That way?
Yes, yes. On the full length of your string. move it this way, yes, towards me, at right angles to the way the cord is hung, further still. We haven't much to show the others, have we? No. A bit further, please, girl. Right, now let go of it. Now I want you to watch what is happening. That swinging object, right, that is a pendulum. You know the law of the pendulum. Its periodicity is a function of its length. You see that one? That one is moving. It's starting to move like this one. And this one is not, and that one is not. And those are dithering about because the cord is being moved, but they're not starting to swing like that one. The reason that one is swinging is because it's the same length as this one. It has the same periodicity. Now let us think about that very carefully. The same periodicity. Inside the human being, with his fundamental, that diameter through his sphere, his soulish sensorium. Inside him, when a stimulus comes, if it has the same periodicity as his fundamental, he will respond. And if it has a relation to that fundamental, a whole number partial, it will also respond. So there's every part of the sensorium mathematically related to that fundamental will begin to go into action. You see this little one, which is apparently the stillest scale. Yeah. Will you do the same thing with that for me, without touching the other? Take it out quite a way, 45 degrees, and then let go of it. I want you to watch what's happening to the others. That is agitating the top line, isn't it? But it has a peculiar periodicity of its own, determined by its length. Remember that the periodicity of a pendulum is a function of its length. That one has not altered the rate of swing of that one, because its pendulum length determines its periodicity. And that one. What's happened to that one? It's a bit still, isn't it? What about that one? Are they doing it? No. Now, I want you to think about this. The line upon which they are slung represents the continuum of the universal sentient power. That line represents the continuum. It is an abstraction. We can draw it on the board with verticals for the pendula hanging from it. And we can say this line is an abstracted line out of what in fact is an infinite three-dimensional continuum. That line, if we know the thickness of it, is a one-dimensional continuum. It has length, but it has no depth and breadth if we ignore its thickness. It is an abstraction. But the whole universe itself is a continuum of sentient power, which is infinite. And all that we mean by three-dimensionality is a function of that continuum. You can leave those swinging if you like. Yeah, thank you. Now, I want you to think about this carefully. Imagine these are individual human beings. That one is a baby coming down from the eternal continuum, and this one is born a bit later, and that one is born a bit later, and these two are born at the same time. So the length of the thing can be a representation of their age. We could make a graph illustrating that usage of the terms. Now we can see that the periodicity of the baby is short. If we swing that one, because of the shortness of that cord, it will swing very, very rapidly. Its periodicity will be very quick compared with these two long ones. So we could expect that the interest of a baby is as short-lived as the length of its lifespan. Now, that's not merely a fairy tale. If you think hard about it, the amount of energy that a baby can put into any single stimulus to begin with is very short compared with the amount of energy a developed man, like, say, Alfred Einstein, Albert Einstein, and his sister, Palfred Einstein. Those beings of tremendous dedication throughout life, thinking about the same subject matter, can apply themselves over a longer period of time to the same subject matter. Right? And what happens if a grown-up person, we'll say there's a man and there's a woman, and they've got the same length, they've got the same periodicity, so they say they are like each other, and at the aesthetic level of liking, disliking, they say that because they are similar, they like each other. In other words, when they fall in love, they've really fallen in love with a portion of their own being. It's only self-witness falling in love with other beings. You see something in them that you think is like something in you, and then you think how nice that person is because they're so like me. So I'll grasp onto it, and it will be exactly that. If I swing this husband, that wife will swing, and if I swing the wife, the husband will swing. And supposing they then get together and produce a short stringed baby, their periodicity is not the same. Are the parents aware that the baby's perceptual sensorium activity is very quick and very short-lived? Or do they think that it should be as long and continued as theirs is? Generally, parents expect their children to do what is called growing up and attend to the things that the parents consider are most worthy of attention, like success, big houses, big cars, big money, knighthoods and so on. All the things that the world has swung into existence, because when one of these moves, it's an example to the others to move likewise, insofar as they can respond to it. If then the long string pendulum talks to the little short string pendulum and tells it to hurry up, can the little pendulum actually do it? Or will it have to wait till it's got a longer string? It will have to wait. And I've seen some very distressing cases of children who've been accelerated by parental power beyond their capacity, and instead of growing up quickly, they have simply collapsed and become ill. For a simple reason, a vibrational incapacity to adjust to a stimulus of the wrong type. That's all. Now, when we strike a note on the piano like this, it is customary to talk to babies when you're learning the piano, and for a certain reason to start with middle C. Because if you start and stay on the white note, you can make a scale like this. That's a diatonic scale, which has been evolved, especially in Europe, for a very definite purpose. It isn't the only scale. And as a matter of fact, between this note and this note, not much distance is, there are about 25 other notes that we can't play on a keyboarded instrument. We can't design within the stretch of your hand a keyboard that can strike an octave like that, which is very important, and then put in 25 other keys in between C and C sharp. Now, that is the usual way of starting to teach a child. Begin on middle C. It's near the keyhole, if you've got a keyhole. This one hasn't got a keyhole. They must have run out of bits for their drills on this one. Now, instead of starting there, it's much more logical to start with A. Because the notation on this piano and this organ, and most of the fretted instruments and keyboard instruments, to use the first seven letters of the alphabet to name those notes. Now, is there anybody here that does not know the first seven letters of the alphabet? Is there? A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Now, the piano is arranged with three black notes together, and then two white notes, three black, two white, three black, two white, three black, two white. All the way up the piano. So you look at the piano, and you take any three black notes that are together, you strike the middle one, and immediately to the right of that one, the white one, you call A. Now, staying on the white notes, you play up A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And then you start again, A. And this second A, again, is exactly to the right of the middle one of the black ones, where there are three black ones together. So any person, immediately, without any further lessons, knows all the notes on the piano by simply saying, wherever there are three black notes close together, I find the middle one, and the one to the right of that I call A, and then staying on the white notes, I just name them A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the way up the piano, and I've named all the white notes. Now, the black notes you can call by the same name as the white notes with the addition of sharp or flat. So if I say there is A, and the black note below it, I can call, when I'm descending, A flat. And if I go down to the next note, G, I can go up to the one I've just called A flat, and because I'm ascending, I can call it G sharp. So the one called A flat is also called G sharp. So we know the names of all the black notes too. They're the same notes that we have named A to G on the white notes, but we call them either sharp or flat according to our convenience. So everybody in this room now knows the names of all the notes on the piano. Is it a dissenter in the house? Would Gerhard like to say he doesn't know all the notes on the piano? If so, I'll ask him to come here and demonstrate that he can find them immediately by that simple rule. Would you like to do that, Gerhard? I may give the game away. I'm telling you that Gerhard and I have been rehearsing all afternoon with this.
I suppose this is the A, isn't it?
You see, he immediately points to the A and says, I suppose it is the A, and it is the A. Take any three notes, yes? And call, that's A. You know, staying on the white notes, just march up one at a time and say the first seven letters of the alphabet. Call them out.
A,
B,
E, F,
G. Right? Those are the names of those notes. Right?
Yeah.
Now, the black notes you can call either sharp or flat, according to convenience and nothing else. And it's more convenient for you to track what note is that.
That's G.
You can call that one G-flat, or you could call it, starting there, F-sharp. F-sharp. That means so. Find B-flat for me. He immediately strikes B-flat. Can you find me an octave above B flat, another B flat anywhere? Or one lower down, another one? You can find all the notes on the piano. He's now a man possessed of piano notation. I should have dragged that out for 3 years at an hour, 10 guineas per week, and deliberately flogged him so that he couldn't learn it too quickly. Because if he did, he'd turn into a genius. And leave me, and I would starve to death. So I've thrown away, no wonder I'm slim, I've thrown my livelihood away. So you know all the notes, right? And you can find them. Good? And before you go away, I'm going to say something else to you. If we take a note, any note, and the next note to it, and play them both together, there's C, C sharp, it will make a discord. Yeah?
Yeah.
With that rule, find me any discord on the piano you care to make. If you were to note that down, you'd become a modern composer. Really? Really? I mean, the ability to do that. What's that? Prokofiev, isn't it? Now, don't go away, Gerhard. Now, if you play not the immediately next door notes, but this one and play there, you've still got the discord, but it is as horrible as the first one. No, it isn't. Right? Now, if we stretch the distance a little further, there, is that a discord?
No.
What does it sound like? Count the number of notes. How many? One, two, three, four notes.
Four.
Right?
There's a certain harmony in it, isn't there?
Yes, but is it gay or sand?
Well, I would call it neither one nor the other. It's a bit of a
right.
Halfway house.
You're a halfway house. Now, suppose we take five notes up to there. Because you cannot evaluate anything without comparison with another thing. Play this one, and then this one. Tell me whether one feels more cheerful than the other.
This resolves, the second one resolves the first, doesn't it?
Now, which is the sadder?
Oh, the first.
The first?
Yes.
The reason is simple. This note vibrates one part of your sensorium. In the ear, you've got a horn that vibrates one part, and this one vibrates the next part adjacent to it. So that if you play both together like that, it actually starts tearing the eardrum because they're next door to each other. But if we increase the distance, have a few more cells between, we get this, that disturbs it less, increase the distance again. That disturbs it less, increases it again. We get a diad there, which is consonant. Two notes, which are quite happy. Now, suppose I wanted to make Way Down on the Swanee River a little bit sad. Instead of playing. I do the minor third instead of that major one. What's happened now? I played a minor third and a minor sixth instead of the major. I moved the vibrations towards each other in my middle ear, and I get a little bit frightened. Yes, to pick a D. Back to the major. You see, by stretching the soul, the sensorium, we can actually make it feel freer. When it feels freer, it feels happier. Yes? Is there a voice in the house? Sheila, sing that for me. You know the words, don't you? Now into the minor. Can you see what we're doing with the human soul? Can you feel it? We are actually, by means of sound waves, which are alternations of compression, decompression, putting stresses and strains upon the soul. And if we've overstressed it, and then we stretch it away from the stress, we release it from a depressive state. As a matter of fact, some of the scales that were used by the ancient Greece government were disallowed because they made people mawkish and sad and sexy. Whereas some other scales made them very martial and thoroughly decent citizens. There is music that makes you feel like a citizen. Do you think there is? Would you go to war for that? Would you go to war for that? Which would you go to war with? It is actually true that governments in the ancient world, in Babylonia, in India, in Egypt, in Greece, actually studied music, and every citizen in Athens knew the rules of music, had a musical education, and could actually join in musical festivals. Not the slaves at the bottom, but the citizens, the qualified, the ones who were allowed to walk on the pavement out of the mud. They had been trained in music. So they knew that if you strike that note and that note, and both together, you have a dissonance. Now let's apply this to human beings. And would you like to sit down here? Thank you. Every human being is a sensorium of sentient power, unique. The amount of energy in each being is unique, and when economically deployed correctly, is spherical, with a diameter peculiar to itself, with a resonance peculiar to itself, with sympathetic vibrations within itself. And if it is subject to a stimulus from another being with a dissonant, discordant frequency of pulses, then its own sensorium is made miserable. Now, I can't swing one of these things, can I, without swinging the sensorium, the continuum. Supposing, you see, somebody's bouncing up and down a bit, but they're not swinging, are they? Because they haven't got the length and therefore the periodicity of that one. But supposing we have two beings of the same family with the same genetic structures in them, then certain of their partials will be similar, so that if one person, we'll say this one, goes in a depressed mood and contributes to the continuum there, the pulsing of that mood, then another person over here, related genetically to it, without physically being present, could be in Australia. So a mood here from one person could actually produce a mood in another person on holiday in the Bahamas and ruin their holiday. I'm not joking. This is true. And this is why you have to learn, when you have a mood, to say to yourself, is it mine? Did I originate it? Or is it just one of the family contributions? Where the same genetic code is, there are resonances. And when you intermarry people, you may be marrying some concordances, or you might be marrying together dissonances. And when this occurs, the resultant child has an internal problem of resolving discordances produced by nothing except vibratory functions of the ancestors of both parents. That's why in the ancient world it was considered to be a very important duty. Socrates would say the midwife is the one fit to do it. That possibly was true in the ancient world, it's probably not so true today. But the midwife, because of her much experience, and especially the older the midwife, the more likely, the midwife with much experience of delivering children from particular kinds of parents and watching the children grow up, She was most equipped to say that pair will do well to get married and they will produce a child which will be talented in a certain way, and this pair would be ill-advised because they don't match with their frequencies. Now, when we use the piano, we're using an instrument that has little hammers in, and the sounds fade away very quickly, even if I do put the sustaining pedal on. It's fading away. So we have here another instrument, which is a cheap Italian organ, which will do for the purpose, although it has no mode, no device for modifying the amplitude of the waves. But it will produce a continuous concord or discord where we can actually observe the phenomena called beat frequencies. When two notes are very close together but are not exactly in phase with each other, then the difference of the frequency, the pulses per second, produces a beat. And on the lower levels of this instrument, you can hear that beat fairly clearly. If I play this, and then this, and then both together, you will hear them interfering. Can you hear that interference? Now there's what we call a semitone between them, a half a tone. That's merely a convenience of terminology. Now, if I say, if we play an octave, that note and that note fit together beautifully and they help each other and fill each other out. If I now play this note next to this one, both together, you hear a banging sound. We call that a beat frequency. If I play them very close to each other like this, it's pretty obvious. But supposing I separate that, you can't really count the beats so easily there, can you? So that's really this. It's less annoying, isn't it, than this. Can you hear distraction here? Supposing we played three notes that disagree with each other. As we increase the distance between them, we give more space in the sensorium, more interspace, more free cells, so that we're not so much damaged. Bad. Not so bad. Tolerable, but a bit sad. Tolerable. Minor third. Major third. Fourth. Tolerable. Fifth. Very tolerable. Sixth. Tolerable. Seventh, not tolerable. Octave, completely tolerable. Now let's think about that in terms of human beings. Every human being is an energy mass, and the energy is sentient, and that mass is in a state of continuous vibration because it is under continuous stimulation and tends to respond to the stimulus to adjust it. If you give the person next to you a push, that person will tend to counteract the push to maintain equilibrium. Now, in exactly the same way, when you get an idea and offer it to another person, if that idea is not part of the inbuilt assimilated pattern of the person you offer it to, what you actually do is that. You must find a method of producing a relationship with sufficient distance between. So you don't ask somebody what they believe in most strongly and then shout, "That's a load of rubbish." Bishop of Birmingham, Hugh Montefiore, said this morning, when I pray to God, I don't expect him to answer me very well. I mean, the kind of things I want, I have to be very careful about what I ask for. I mean, it actually has to be in accord with God's will, wouldn't it? And he is omniscient anyway. So he must know what I want. He didn't say the next bit, so if he already knows what am I asking him for, he must already be giving it to me. And in that case, what I'm praying for is clarity in me. I'm not trying to inform God. God is the continuum. When one of those little fellows says, I think I'll give God a little joke. I want a new fridge. And that's transmitted all along the line. And if there are any fridge sellers about the place, they go, customer, I can feel a customer. I'm convinced today there's a customer. And we are all being manipulated by the continuum, which has all the information of all the pendulums suspended from it. It is omniscient. Whatever we think we know, however clever we think we are, all that information, because we are modalities of the continuum, all that information is in the continuum. It's got it. Plus all the information of all the other individuated pendula that exist. So it is impossible for any individual hanging down from that continuum to keep a secret from the continuum, because he is a modality of the continuum. And that continuum is sentient power, so it knows what to give you for your next lesson. And it has a terrible trick of giving you what you want and then letting you pay the price of it at your leisure. We see that the musical analogy makes us feel in a very vulnerable position. Whatever we do, we are in grave danger of stimulating the continuum to stimulate some other pendular individuals hanging from it to do something about what we have desired. Now, when we use a keyboard instrument like a piano or an organ, or a fretted instrument like a guitar, the notes are stepped up clearly from each other, like this, and the notes between are missed out. Now, we can't therefore demonstrate on a piano a true glissando. We use the term glissando, and we mean a thing like this. But it isn't truly a slip. Then this funny instrument, which is a baby, I used to play in my cot, and was then called a swanny whistle, is not stepped, it has no keys, and it slides. So it's got all the notes that are missing from the piano. Now, that being so, what happens if a person, this thing is called sage, because he knows how to adjust. An ordinary European musician plays on a vol-tempered clavier. He plays on a piano with tempered notes, balanced notes, between those two notes. We have a number of other notes, stepped, with F sharp between them. And none of the in-between notes are there. So we can't fool about. Now, pop singers, and by that I don't mean those tone-deaf, untuned guitar, physical experts in walking about. I mean, any good voiced but well-known popular singer has a trick. He goes, when he wants to be sad, slightly lower than the note would be if he were happy. He sings slightly flat. And then when he wants to, he sings slightly sharp. He glides on it. And he does this deliberately because, I'll ask Sheila to help again. Will you sing me that third? Right, now I want you to sing me that E slightly flat. very hard, isn't it, Sheila? Can you hear your voice? You started to do it and then you slid up, didn't you? Yeah. Try it again. Now you hear that little trick. Now that little slide onto a note can actually give you £1 million from the populace. Yeah, but you become a popular singer by doing it. You see, if you made in strict classical form a record, the populace would not buy it. But if you actually made your notes and slid them subtly, not fantastically excessively, but say like Sinatra or Perry Como, they're doing this on each note, right? Now, supposing you have, and you showed there that it's quite difficult for you to sing a flat major third, because you've been trained, you're so well trained that you can only sing correctly. Now, supposing you meet people that are not correct, or supposing you go to another country, say in the Far East, where they are not confined to semitones as their basic units, but they have quarter tones and eighth tones, and it would sound to you as if they were singing very flat or very sharp. And if you sang it, they'd say, that's not right, you're singing too cheerfully, it's miserable. I saw an Indian girl, and she was in a sort of dirty brown dress, which is quite clean, but the colour was dirty brown. And she asked, why are you wearing this dull colour? And she said, I cannot wear bright pink when I'm singing a sad song. She was quite correct. You see, she had a lovely, delicious icing top pink on, and you saw her, you thought, oh, she's not miserable enough. And she had the sensitivity to tone down the colour in her dress. Now, in the same way, you have to tone down your form of a dress when you meet another person. There are cultural differences, there are differences of formal logic, and there are differences of speech styles. So if you talk to a Pakistani, to a Hindu, to a Belfast Protestant, to a deep South American, there are different cultural assumptions, different modes of logic, and different modes of speech. And if you don't think about it and allow for it, you will fail to communicate. And you can actually introduce dissonant ideas into them, and they may be so well trained that they won't let you know it, but they've crossed you off as an intelligent person because you have introduced an alien idea to their cultural pattern. Can I have your assistance again, please, Gerhard? I want to show what I mean with this slide instrument, because this slide instrument can, in fact, go anywhere in the cracks. Yeah. We're going to play on this one now, so I'll switch the wind on there. Now, see that note?
Yeah.
Will you put your finger on it for me? This is approximately the bottom note on this. Now, supposing I sharpen this a bit and you keep that note on. Can you hear what's happening there? We're producing a beat frequency. And I'm playing the same note but slightly sharper. Now that is exactly like agreeing with another person, but not quite. Now you get this every day, yes, quite, but. I used to have the word but printed on little cards and hand it out every time I heard it. And I found it was very expensive, so I gave it up. Now let's see what happens. Play that note for me. I'm going to slide this device up and you will hear the beats disappear and it will start becoming concordant. Those two go together, don't they? I'll continue pushing. Got to talk about that. They suddenly began to mingle together, didn't they? Thanks, Gerhard. When you're in total agreement with another person, remember an idea is a form of energy, and every energy form vibrates at its own periodicity. Actually, vibrates in a way peculiar to itself. Its own periodicity, its own frequency, it may vary its amplitude, that is its degree of loudness or quietness, but it has this unique capacity. And when you use a word, that word represents an idea. And that idea is vibrating. And that vibration is either consonant or dissonant with another idea in the minds of other people. And it can be the occasion of Carter saying, if necessary, we are prepared to go to any lengths in our relations with Iran. They're only words, aren't they? But aren't the words ideas? And aren't the ideas vibratory energies? And have they not the capacity in the brain to release from energy stores of ideas a group of ideas, just in the same way that one of those notes plus the sustaining pedal begins to wake other notes? Everybody is waking up by an idea, and that could mean a finger on the button to press a nuclear bomb. Do you feel the threat? Bit of Wagner. What's the meaning of that F sharp there? Can you feel the threat? Something's wrong. In the brain, in the word, in the idea, in the resonance of all those ideas which have nothing but vibratory energy form. The wrong word uttered in 1 second can totally destroy a relation that has been built up carefully for years. And that one word, which is an idea, could be so dissonant with the other ideas inside the listener that it is utterly unassimilable, and it will have to be thrown out, and the relation is cut. Because if A says a certain word, which means a certain idea, which means a certain form of vibratory energy incompatible with B, and B cannot assimilate it, then it is not only the vibratory energy form and the idea and the word, but the person that uttered the word who has now smashed the relation. It is not a figure of speech. What's it all about? about this one. What's that about? The fundamental thing apply, isn't it? And what's the story about? It's just the same old story. A fight for love and glory. A bid to do or die. To do or die. How do you feel about it? Why did a little song with a few words attached to it make $1 million? Because it was talking about fundamentals. I mean, even if you don't like popular songs, can you ignore the truth? What are you fighting for? Love and glory. That's all. Is it time to go in for a drink now? Free will is initiative. Initiative, initio, I begin. It means now. It's always here and now. On the sinister side of a shield, we write past and future. On the dexter side, we write now. People, 95%, think about the past, the things they might have done better, and the future, the glorious time that they would have had if they had in the past have done something better. But the 5% don't do that. They seize the instant, immediate moment, and they do there the best application that is open of the principle they know. And that is the only freedom. The rest of behavior is mechanical reactivity to the swinging bobs of other individuals and the impulses of the continuum transmitted. Because when we think about sound transmitting, we have three things: the source of the sound, the recipient of the sound, and the mediating of the sound. There is the source, we swing that one. There is the mediating line, and there is the recipient. Always those three. And the way to get out of the duality of the initiator of the sound there, the recipient there, is climb up to the continuum. All you need to do is remember the concept, I am the continuum, here, now, modalizing. There's no difference between you and God, except he is infinite and you have determined to be finite. That is to identify yourself with a given character. So you just turn your head upside down and look at that line, the horizontal line, look at it that way and call it substance. Look at it this way and call it superstance. Actually, the super and sub have the same etymology because it depends nothing but identification with your point of view. We are substantially divine beings. We are substantially divine beings. If we are substantial, then all these bombs are standing up, outstanding, existential in time. The other way we look at them, and they're hanging, they're pendant upon God, that is, upon the long continuum of sentient power. And when you remember that, hangingness, you say you repent. That means re-hang. You are rependulating yourself. You are saying, after all, I've identified, I think I'm a certain kind of person. My mother was Scottish, my father was Jewish. What was his father? Funny, his father was Jewish and his mother was Scottish. That's a bit funny, isn't it? How do I know? The rule is, get rid of that rubbish, that's identification. What am I really? I'm a sensorium, a precipitate of the eternal, sentient power. And so is everyone else. But they've all been miseducated to think that they're little bombs on their own, and they've got to go out and shoot other bombs in order to survive. Which is quite silly. An ego, Agre, philosopher, after whom a club was named, said you play some tunes on the white notes and some tunes on the black notes, but the best is tunes you played on both. Now it's true. If we take all the black notes on the piano, we have a ratio of notes called a pentatonic scale. And on that scale you can play Chinese, you can play Gaelic, you can play Arabic, all primitive musics. Now here's an example. Can you hear that that's Jerusalem disguise, apart from one note? Yes? The one note would have been a white note. And I deliberately confined myself to the black notes. Is that Gaelic? It is. What about this one? Is that Chinese? It's pentatonic. Because a very, very early sensitivity in the human protoplasm was to five. The tendency to hear, and there are three. And there are two. And Jesus says, three fight two in one house. Those two fight those three. In the same way, your head and your heart and your mediators fight each other. Your physical body inertias, your pleasure pain sensitivity, your time mentation, your intellective conceptual self and your volition. Volition and intellection, physical inertia and pleasure pursuit, fight. And the middle finger can choose to go on either side. Three fight two and two fight three. And it is there. And you can play literally hundreds of tunes after those five notes, and most of those tunes have been in the top 20 for centuries. And they are still there. And they're still the basis of most of the tunes that make the grade. So all the best Jewish composers are pentatonic. True. Irving Berlin wrote a whole pile of things. And so did all the other famous composers. Based on those notes, you can't go wrong on them. You can transpose those intervals into other keys if you wish for fun. But fundamentally, all your melodic lines are based on that pentatonic scale, in the same way that all your life is based on your physical body, your like-dislike, your mentational processes, your conceptual grasp and your free will. That's all you have to play with. And you can play with it any way you like. Now, for technical reasons, in Europe, they don't like anything that's not military and not concerned with beating people up. To do with being a Caucasian. And that was to do with the terrain, which is just the right temperature and the right rugged background to make you feel fit. And if you found anybody unfit, you thumped them and took whatever they had, and redefined them as slaves and let them wash your feet. They're then called slaves. That means foot washers. In other countries, they like something a bit other than that. So you might get a... Do you feel like bashing anybody? depressing anybody? Well, in those countries where they like that kind of soft relationship and minor intervals and quarter tones and things, well, they're not going to go to fight. Try to fight to this one. And with the tremolo. To go to war for that. I never did like Colonel Bogey when I was a boy. I still like fooling about. Yeah. There's a nice bass for her. Now, we sat it as a chord, the old fit. Had a six into it. Six means sex, listen. What's happened to that? Invert it, put the six at the bottom. You don't feel war, no. But on the sinister side of a heraldic shield, they don't put warlike people. They're on the right hand side, strong, mighty arm. And anybody who likes slop, like I like it, by me a bit too shame, or this is before your time. Oh, how am I to know? Is this really love that came my way, dear? But oh, how am I to know? Is this really love that came to stay, dear? What do you think about rubbish like that? Do you know Falling Leaves? Will you sing Falling Leaves with me? Thank you. Cartoon. That's all, folks.